Well, good afternoon. Thank you to the Melbourne Institute for the invitation to speak at what looks to be a very interesting conference. The theme of new directions in an uncertain world certainly has a lot of resonance at the moment in any manner of ways, political, economic, social and environmental. Many of these themes have I've seen been examined during the course of the conference, but the theme of this session, of course, is Are the Banks Too Big? And I think Kevin's done a great job sort of setting out how you might consider that question, and Katie's done a great job of looking at the what I call the consumer protection aspects. I'm going to focus on taking the banking structure as given, and I'm going to talk about what the implications of that might be for financial stability, the stability of the Australian financial system. So first of all, a bit of background. Australia has always had a fairly concentrated banking system. So through this graph shows that through the 60s and the 70s, the major banking groups, there was up to eight at that point, accounted for around about 80% of the banking assets in Australia. Now, following the deregulation, the entry of the foreign banks in the mid-80s, the share declined to around about 65%. And it remained around about that level, up and down a little bit, until the global financial crisis, when the share of the major banks, and by this time there were only four, it rose back to 80%. Kevin's already highlighted that the concentration of the banking system in Australia is not unique internationally, but it is a little bit, I'd say, probably at the high end. There are other countries that have very similar levels of concentration to Australia, perhaps even a bit higher, so including Canada and Sweden. But there are actually many other countries that have much lower levels of concentration, and that would include the United States, the United Kingdom, and a number of European countries. Aside from the concentration, there's a couple of other features of the Australian banking system that I think are worth highlighting. First of all, if we look at cost-to-income ratios, the Australian banks seem to be fairly efficient. So on average, the four major Australian banks, this is just the four majors, have a cost-to-income ratio of around 40%. That's at the lower end of the cost-to-income ratios for a selection of banks in other countries. New Zealand is a bit lower than us. It's likely that this reflects in part differences in the business models of the banks. So banks like the Australian banks and the New Zealand banks, with a greater emphasis on traditional lending activity, tend to have lower cost-to-income ratios than banks with a greater focus on other activities, for example, such as investment banking or wealth management. Second feature is that the major Australian banks are very profitable. For a brief period after the global financial crisis, returns on equity for the major Australian banks, apart from a brief period after the global financial crisis, the returns on equity for the major Australian banks have been consistently around about 15% or even higher in some years. Their performance has been helped, of course, by a long run of consistent economic growth in Australia. We haven't had a recession in over 25 years. So our banks haven't had to deal with the substantial credit losses that have impinged so heavily on the profits of so many overseas banks following the financial crisis. This profitability has also meant that the banks have found it relatively easy to build capital in response to international moves to improve the resilience of the banking system worldwide. So while we have a concentrated banking system, the major banks appear relatively efficient and strong. So what then can we say about the implications of this structure for financial stability? Does having a relatively concentrated banking system promote financial stability, or does it make the system more susceptible to shocks? I have to say the answer to this question is really not very straightforward. There's one view that would say a concentrated banking system promotes financial stability in a number of ways. For example, it's sometimes argued that if a concentrated banking system implies less competition, the large banks will be more profitable and they're able to generate capital organically, and that increases their resilience. This argument suggests that a concentrated banking system will promote financial stability. Having a few large banks might also promote financial stability in a number of other ways. For example, larger banks might be more diversified in the risks they take, and they might have more sophisticated risk management systems, a topic that Kevin alluded to. It might also be argued that it's easier for our prudential regulator, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, it's easier for them to supervise and regulate a small number of large banks. On the other hand, an alternative view is that a concentrated banking system results in large banks that are too big to fail, and Kevin again alluded to this. So according to this argument, this isn't good for financial stability if this implicit guarantee encourages banks perhaps to take on excessive risk in the knowledge that they won't be allowed to fail. Furthermore, if the large banks all have very similar business models, and Kevin mentioned this before, they do in Australia, problems in one bank might actually portend problems in another bank, and hence there is a systemic issue. If anything, the major Australian banks' business models have become even more similar over the years since the financial crisis. They're all much more heavily focused now on housing lending, and some are pulling back from wealth management and international operations. Finally, it could also be argued that a large bank is by its nature more complex and hence more difficult to supervise than a lot of smaller banks. So, two arguments. The academic literature, I don't think, provides much guidance on which of these views is actually likely to be more relevant for Australia. But is there anything we can say from experience over the past couple of decades since deregulation? Has increasing competition from new entrants had an impact on financial stability? Has the concentration of the banking system resulted in concerns about financial stability? I'll take both these issues in turn. The issue of competition in Australia's banking system has generated a lot of interest, and Katie, in fact, highlighted some of this. There's been a myriad of reviews and inquiries over the year, and indeed another inquiry into competition in the financial system undertaken by the Productivity Commission has just kicked off, and the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has recently been tasked with keeping a watching brief on competition in the financial system. The bank supports the Productivity Commission's work on competition, but in the context of what competition might mean for financial stability, I think it's worth making three points. The first is that concentration of itself does not necessarily imply a lack of competition. Indeed, indicators of market structure, such as measures of concentration, are not regarded as a very accurate measure of competition. In principle, four large banks could still compete very actively among themselves. So if you have a concern that competition could lead to financial instability, having a concentrated banking system won't necessarily address this issue. Second, competition tends to be pro-cyclical. Competition on the lending side tends to hot up during good times. Lending for housing, for example, has been pretty competitive over the past few years. In tougher times, however, competition for some types of funding, particularly more stable types, tend to increase. So post-crisis, for example, banks look to increase the amount of deposit funding relative to wholesale funding, increasing competition for deposits and in particular for term deposits. So regulators need to be aware of this cyclicality and take it into account when considering financial stability. Third, at least some sectors of the market do appear to be contestable, as demonstrated by the impact that new entrants have periodically had on the competitive landscape. The arrival of mortgage originators in the 1990s, for example, generated more competition in the housing lending space. And foreign bank branches have utilised intragroup funding and wholesale deposits to compete in areas such as institutional lending. Despite the dominance of the four major banks in the market for deposits, competition has increased in this space as well. Foreign banks have introduced innovative new online savings accounts, allowing them to compete for deposits without having a large physical presence. More recently, financial technology brings the possibility of even more contestability in the financial system. Competition and innovation are to be encouraged, but regulators nevertheless need to be alert to developments and any potential implications for financial stability. There is consequently a great deal of interest internationally on whether developments in financial technology will have implications for financial stability. So while competition can at times pose challenges for the stability of the financial system, it's also true that large banks pose particular risks. A strong framework of prudential regulation and proactive supervision is therefore necessary, regardless of the specific structure of the system. The actions taken on housing lending over the past few years are an example of how active supervision can address risks that might arise in an environment of heightened competition. So over the past few years, the regulators had observed very strong growth in lending to investors for housing. For a large share of that lending was also interest only. And so for the first 5 to 10 years of the loan, loans weren't being amortised. That's a very long time. And this behaviour was being fuelled by competition between the banks. Individual banks were reluctant to pull back from this lending because if they did so, the business would go to their competitors. So this raised concerns about financial stability implications if this behaviour continued. So in late 2014, with the support of the Council of Financial Regulators, APRA introduced a 10% speed limit, if you like, on growth in investor housing credit, as well as tighter lending standards. And the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, ASIC, supported this work with a great deal of work on responsible lending. This was followed up in March this year with a limit on the share of interest-only loans and further guidance on lending standards. As Wayne Byers, who's the chairman of APRA, recently highlighted, the concerns that prompted action were not about competition on interest rates or customer service standards. Rather, the concern was that competition was manifesting itself in an erosion of lending standards. Not only were the banks taking on more risk, but households were carrying a higher level of debt than that they would have to service, which could be particularly concerning in the event of a shock. In other words, it was a financial stability issue, not only because of its potential impact on banks' balance sheets, but also because it was increasing the vulnerability of the household sector. The importance of the four major banks for financial stability is also explicitly recognised in the regulatory framework. Since the financial crisis, there's been a major international effort to increase the resilience of the global financial system, and Australia has been an active participant in this, both in the policy debate and in implementation. There have been a number of elements to this work, raising capital levels, increasing liquidity buffers, identifying and regulating systemically important financial institutions, and addressing the issue of too big to fail. The implementation of capital requirements in Australia has been driven by the international move to higher capital ratios, as well as a desire to ensure that Australian banks are unquestionably strong. We've already talked a bit about the Financial System Inquiry, and it set out the rationale for Australian banks to achieve this. It noted that the concentrated nature of the system and the similar business models of the major banks could exacerbate contagion if one major bank experienced difficulties. With capital levels increasing around the world, the Financial System Inquiry therefore concluded that it was important the Australian regulatory framework continued to evolve to ensure confidence in Australian banks. It also suggested that higher capital ratios would help to reduce the value of any implicit government guarantees. Australian banks' capital levels have therefore risen substantially in recent years, both relative to the past and in relation to international peers. Furthermore, consistent with the Basel framework for domestic systemically important banks, or another acronym, DSIBs, APRA has determined that due to their size, interconnectedness, substitutability and complexity, the major banks should be required to hold more capital against their risk-weighted assets than smaller financial institutions. Specifically, they're required to hold an additional 1% of their risk-weighted assets as Common Equity Tier 1 capital, bringing the minimum Common Equity Tier 1 capital requirement for the major banks to 8%. All of the major banks are currently comfortably above this minimum, but APRA's announcement earlier this week on unquestionably strong capital ratios means that the larger banks in particular will need to build their capital a little further over coming years. As DSIBs, domestic systemically important financial institutions, the banks, major banks are also subject to more intense supervision by APRA. The higher capital levels and the greater intensity of supervision provide confidence that, notwithstanding the systemic importance of the major banks, the Australian financial system is more resilient to shocks than it was in the past. But there's still a need to consider what might happen in the event of a bank failure. Global initiatives in this area have focused on developing appropriate resolution frameworks and on addressing too big to fail. The centrepieces of this work are the Financial Stability Board's key attributes of effective resolution regimes for financial institutions, which I'll call the key attributes, and total loss absorbing capacity, which I'll call awkwardly TLAC, for global systemically important financial institutions. The intention is that the relevant authorities should be able to resolve failing global financial institutions in an orderly manner without taxpayer exposure to loss from solvency support. The total loss absorbing capacity helps to operationalise these key attributes for these global systemically important institutions by ensuring there are sufficient resources to recapitalise a failing institution. This includes securities that could be bailed in the event that losses were large enough to reduce capital below certain minimum levels. It's still too early to determine how effective the new arrangements for resolution are likely to be. Most countries are developing their frameworks for resolution, although if the institution resolved is a large interconnected international bank, the process will be complex and difficult regardless, especially given the cross-border issues associated with resolution. Most countries are also still to finalise their TLAC regimes, so how this might work in practice isn't clear at this stage. But many financial institutions are issuing securities with TLAC-like features, and there have been some recent examples in Europe where these types of securities have played a role in resolving troubled banks. In Australia, we're working on improvements to our resolution framework in line with the key attributes, and legislation is being drafted to give APRA stronger crisis management powers. But the issue of an appropriate regime to enhance banks' loss absorption and recapitalisation capacity, as recommended by the Financial System Inquiry, is still being considered. We'll be watching developments overseas on this issue very closely to determine the appropriate regime for Australia. In conclusion, I want to reiterate that the concentration of the banking system in the four major banks in Australia does not necessarily provide financial stability benefits, nor is it necessarily detrimental to financial stability. But the systemic importance of the four major banks in Australia does mean that they need to have a proportionately greater supervisory focus. The strengthening of capital and liquidity standards post-crisis and the use of proactive and intensive supervision has certainly improved the resilience of the major banks in Australia and the financial system more broadly. The success of other global initiatives to address issues that arise when a bank fails, however, remains to be seen. Thank you.
For those excellent presentations. We have about 20 minutes for question and answer sessions, so I'd ask you just to put up your hand and pose short, succinct questions, and we'll take them as they come. So there should be a microphone somewhere. It's being delivered, yes. You can speak up.
I'm Ben Potter from the Australian Financial Review. Yesterday, the Prime Minister mentioned on a couple of occasions, so it must have been in his points, that property investors needed to note that property, what can go down can go up, and that households are carrying higher levels of debt and there are risks associated with potential movements in interest rates. And Kevin Davis mentioned today that overseas investors look at Australian banks and see them stocked to the gills with housing mortgages and think, how can that be unquestionably strong or safe and resilient? So this is really a question for Michelle Bullock, primarily. Are they wrong? Are they missing something? I mean, are our banks really unquestionably strong when they're so heavily exposed to a housing market that by many assessments, if not all, is overvalued and over-leveraged? Thanks.
So let me make a couple of points with respect to housing generally. We've highlighted housing as a risk in our financial stability review. The issue really is not house prices per se. It's, as you've identified, it's the issue of vulnerabilities of the household sector in particular. If housing prices turn down, what that might mean. And the issue of investors is a particular interest because investors might be more inclined to be pro-cyclical, buying on the way up and selling on the way down. So they might exacerbate cycles. But I would highlight one other point, I think, which is that the housing market issue really at the moment is a tale of two cities. It's about Melbourne and Sydney. If you look at other major cities, you don't tend to have these large price rises. And there are other reasons for house price rises in these cities, which go back to the very basics of supply and demand. So in Sydney, we know that we are coming from a position where perhaps supply had run below, hadn't run as quickly as demand over previous years, and there's some extent that we need to catch up. And in Melbourne, in Victoria, you're seeing very substantial population growth, so demand is growing there as well. So I think that, as I've said, we have highlighted that there are risks associated with high debt levels and income isn't rising very quickly, so debt-to-income ratios are rising. But I'd also say that I think Melbourne and Sydney, there are also some fundamental issues going on that doesn't necessarily mean that we're headed for a housing crash in these cities. So I think we need to just think a little bit about what else is going on that might be driving some of these moves in these cities.
Yeah, if I could follow up, someone has been saying house prices are too high for 10 years. I know I'll be right eventually. I think there are a couple of points that need to be made. One is APRA and the Reserve Bank, I guess, jointly did stress tests of the banking sector, and they were referred to in the recent APRA paper on Unquestionably Strong. And those stress tests from memory included a fall in house prices of 40%, I think, an unemployment rate going up to 10, was it, or some number like that? And, I mean, a range of things. I mean, catastrophe, not just a stress test. And under the APRA's determination of the capital requirements that big banks should have, if that stress test occurred over, that stress situation occurred overnight, we know that it's not going to happen overnight, it's going to be over a period of time and banks can adjust, that the banks would still have enough capital to be well in excess of the trigger point for the bail-in of the hybrid securities. So I think, you know, when you look at all of that, you'd have to say they look unquestionably strong, I think, under the new regime. I think there's two other things, though, that are worth saying. One is that the points about household debt are very important, and the allocation of that across households is very important. But I often wonder whether or not actually sort of looking at the wrong issue, because if you look at household financial assets, they've actually grown as much as household debt. Now, of course, and I might be wrong on my interpretation of the statistics, but I think that's actually superannuation balances included in there. So the issue that arises is the fact that you've actually got households, yes, they've got, their net debt hasn't gone up because they've got this increase in, you know, actually net financial assets. The trouble is all those financial assets are locked away in superannuation, and therefore if you have a situation where people get into problems, they can't access that to pay off the debts they've got. So I think we have to be careful about just looking at the aggregate net debt figures aggregate gross household debt figures, and ignoring the other complications of what's the structure of household balance sheets, both in aggregate but also across the individuals. I think the other point that's worth making in all of this, and this comes back to the issue of competition that was mentioned, is my understanding is that interest-only mortgages are now 40% or something of the total mortgages. I just can't understand how banks could. And this comes back to the issue of, you know, competition can lead to situations where you end up with financial instability or financial risks. The notion that our banks would have just been, you know, pushing interest-only mortgage loans out the door only 10 years after the global financial crisis, that worries me very much.
Hi, it's Genevieve from the Department of Treasury. I just have a question about the TLAC provisions that you say have been implemented in some European countries. So this is particularly for Michelle.
Could you speak in the mic?
Sorry. So with those hybrid securities being triggered in, say, Italy to bail in some of those banks, have they been successful in doing that? And how successful do you think we'd be here in Australia at using bail-in provisions to, I guess, resolve crisis situations? Do you think we'd end up resulting to just the taxpayers again fronting most of the burden?
Are you asking?
Me. I'm sure you'll
have
a view as well.
Are you allowed to answer it?
Look, there hasn't been... you're right, in Europe there has been some examples. In some cases they have been bailed in. In other cases, and you might be thinking in particular, you mentioned Italy specifically, people were bailed in, but to the extent that they were retail investors, the government has tried to shield them somewhat. I think most countries are still... So even though there's these TLAC-like instruments, most countries are still to try and finalise their arrangements. And I think those are the sorts of issues that are going to be important in settling to understand how effective such a regime might be. Can you, in the heat of the moment, actually bail those securities in and use them for what you need to but use them for? So Kevin might be able to...
I can go to town on this, if you like. I think there are real problems in this area. Now, yes, it's true in Europe, in Spain, Bank Popular was the hybrid securities were bailed in together with the shareholders, and the bank was sold to Santander, I think it was, or
Santander.
Yeah, for 1 euro. But when you look at what was actually happening, it's not clear that the bank had a capital problem, but rather there was a run on it. And so one of the issues there is, you know, these things are meant to be triggered if the bank's in a capital deficient, or, you know, or like to become capital deficient. It's not clear that they were, and that might be because the reported capital ratios were just completely crazy. And we all know that as accounting in this, that's a critical issue in this whole area, is to determine what is the capital ratio. You might have a loan on your books for $100, it's actually worth nothing. So your capital ratio is actually, you know, your true capital ratio is actually a lot less because you're overstating the value of the assets. So I think the Spanish one also indicates one of the problems that you've got with these instruments. They basically just said, we're just going to sell the thing over to Santander, get rid of it. That wasn't the original purpose. The original purpose of these things was to facilitate an orderly resolution of the entity. My concern is that if one of the big banks in Australia, any bank in Australia, if APRA said we're going to bail in the hybrid securities, what's going to happen? Everybody's going to run. No one's going to, you know, stay with that bank as a depositor. Even if you're insured, you probably move. And you've got to run, and they're going to have the government, you know, for an orderly resolution, you're going to have the government come in and insure, put a blanket guarantee over the bank to prevent a run and immediate failure of the thing. So I think there's a real, yeah, on the surface, these things look like a really good idea. I think in practice, they're going to be an absolute nightmare. One other point I'd make, global financial crisis 10 years ago was, two points I'll make. The global financial crisis 10 years ago, one of the problems was too many complex instruments being sold to investors or complex loans that they didn't understand. What have we got now? We've got really complex financial instruments that people can't value being sold to retail investors. You know, there's been 40 billion of these of these sorts of securities issued and listed on the ASX, bought mainly by retail investors. So we've got regulations that are actually inducing banks to issue very complex, impossible to value securities, I would say, and they're being sold to retail investors. That doesn't seem to me to be a sensible thing. The last point I make would be that there are two sorts of these hybrid securities. One is what are referred to as additional Tier 1 capital, which are the ones that have been sold to retail investors. There's also Tier 2 hybrid instruments that have been sold primarily to overseas investors or wholesale markets. The pecking order is such that if a bank gets into trouble, or looks like it's getting into trouble, and APRA says we're going to bail in these things, it should be the additional Tier 1 securities that get bailed in first before the Tier 2. Now, just imagine what's going to happen if we have a situation where APRA and the government say we're going to bail in all the retail investors who are the self-managed super funds and other retail investors, and you know the value of their instruments, of their securities, is going to go to hell. But we're going to leave the international investors free.
it ain't going to happen. Well, it might. You might be in that position. You might have to authorise it at some stage. But it just seems to me that this is one of those innovations that look good on paper, but once you start to really get into it, no, I just think it's not good.
And I couldn't possibly say any of that.
So I had a question from a gentleman in the middle of the room and a lady down here at the front. So perhaps we'll take both of those and allow the panel to respond to them collectively.
Roger Wilkins, Melbourne Institute. I actually just wanted to give the Shadow Minister an opportunity to respond to Kevin Davis, who his assertion that a Royal Commission wasn't warranted. So.
Well, unsurprisingly, after my presentation, I respectfully disagree with Kevin on that point. And I think, again, I tried to pose the question in my presentation. Politicians are elected to respond to community issues, community concern, and there's no doubt there's a substantial issue here that's being raised across the country. And I think it is... in coming to this position, I think Labor did consider, and it was prior to my time in taking this portfolio, Labor had engaged consistently with financial institutions, raising concerns, and I think the response at the end of the day, by the time we came to this position, was, not enough action had occurred, and that if we were in government, the time was to have a very close look at what was going on. I accept that the regulators are there and they do, they intervene, they have a very full program. I think we can have the discussion around resources as well, but I think in looking, a Royal Commission would also look at those issues, Are the regulators resourced appropriately? Do they have the right powers? Are they intervening at the right point? It's not just to solely look at one aspect of the financial system. It would look more broadly. But again, I think if you had to deal with my daily inbox, at some point you have to accept that there is a genuine issue here, and it's not something that can be just laid back at 2008. It's a situation of people walking in the door pretty consistently. And, I think when I first took the job, I sort of inquired with the banks why they were so opposed to it, because it seemed to me they were saying, look, we're on top of everything. There's nothing to see here. Where there's been shortcomings, we're addressing them. We're changing our culture. We're really putting an effort in. And my question to them was, well, if that's the case, what is your major concern? And really the only concern they could raise with me was a perception, how it would be seen, particularly from overseas, if the government of the day called a Royal Commission into them. Labor's response to that is that, many, the reputational damage and issues like trust and confidence has, that train has left the station. And that's actually exactly what we would want to see a Royal Commission do, was return that trust, return that confidence, and provide the opportunity for all of the issues, including how the regulatory system works and whether it works in the best interests of consumers, to be looked at in the most thorough way. But I accept there's different opinion on that. I do. I hear that pretty consistently too.
I was curious. Last night the Treasurer said something about a policy to encourage lenders with low capitalisation. What impact would that have on this situation? He was talking about banks of some sort without very low capitalisation.
I'm not sure. I was there, and maybe I went to sleep then. But I shouldn't say that, should I? Could it be peer-to-peer lenders?
I wasn't there. I don't know. I'm wondering, certainly there's a lot of debate about, and you mentioned it, the customer-owned banking associations. Yeah. I don't know whether he was sort of looking to push more from those sort of lenders.
I think I was awake, actually. I think what it was, as in the UK, they've allowed small start-up banks, and
in Australia, the government has reduced the minimum capitalisation to call yourself a bank.
Yeah, 50.
So one of the things on the Financial System Inquiry, we talked about whether we should get rid of the crazy term authorised deposit taking institutions, ADIs, which no one knows what it means outside of Australia, not even inside Australia, let them all call themselves banks. And up until a few years ago, a mutual organisation couldn't call itself a bank. They changed the legislation to allow those that had $50 million in equity capital to call themselves a bank, and now they've removed that entirely. So anyone who's got a licence can call themselves a bank. I actually thought, when you started, I thought maybe he'd been talking about an alternative form of financing, which is the peer-to-peer lending, which to me is one of the areas where they don't need any capital, I mean, because they're just operating as a platform and connecting you as a person with some money to lend it across to a whole lot of potential borrowers. And I see that as actually one of the major potential threats to the banking sector, these new platforms where sophisticated investors or even unsophisticated investors can invest directly in a portfolio of loans from the people in this room or wherever and be diversified in that way. Because the platform isn't taking on any of the credit risk, they don't need the capital adequacy like a bank does. They have to be strong enough for the platform to survive. But it's a very different type of financing.
Would there be any regulation?
Sorry?
Would there be any regulation?
There would be regulation as per ASIC in the sense
ASIC,
of...
That's the sort of thing that ASIC would regulate. And ASIC, in fact, has its sort of regulatory sandbox, and that's the sort of thing that you might anticipate would be in that space.
ASIC's been struggling, well, was struggling for quite a while with how they should regulate these entities because they just didn't fit into any... of the, and they've been regulating them effectively as a managed investment scheme, which I think is not a bad way of doing it, but I think there's probably better ways actually. But that's for another day.
So I think we're about time. I offer the panel if you wanted to say something quickly each to sum up 30 seconds. I'll offer you that. You don't have to take it.
I don't think I have anything left to add on.
Can I just move closer to Katie in the sense of saying one of the benefits, I mean, I think ASIC has all of the same, if not more, powers than a Royal Commission because it can actually take action itself rather than just recommending action. The benefit of a Royal Commission is that it wouldn't be the regulators doing the investigating, and some part of the whole debate might be about do the regulators have the power, did they have the right activities and so on. So there is some merit in an external... body as opposed to ASIC, but I think if you want to name and shame, ASIC's got all the powers it needs there.
Okay, well, it's left to me just to ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an excellent discussion.